This podcast is brought to you by Lanco Group, your business partner for engineering solutions. You are listening to FNR Football Nation Radio.
It's time for the lightning round on FNR Football Nation Radio.
It's Friday, and you know what that means. It's time for the lightning round here on FNR Football Nation Radio, the second ever edition of this show. I'm Josh Parrish. This is Nick DiBano, and for the next hour, we're going to argue about all things football, local and European. And Nick, what are we going to start with? We're going to rattle off 20 topics within the hour, see if we can get through them. What's first up?
Well, let's first just address the elephant in the room. We're today standing by Hamilton Azzurri, as you can see by our jumpers. And also, just a little quick shout out, you'll be speaking to Jim Sneesby a little bit later on in evenings in the next hour. But a bit of an interesting day in terms of NCIP. And let's actually start there, because that's been almost the talk of the town over the past day or so. It's almost borderline hypocrisy after some of the tweets we saw from Joseph Carozzi only on Wednesday. And then you see this media statement today come out from Northern New South Wales about that it's still in place.
And citing none other than FFA board member Joseph Carozzi as the source for that information, whereas Carozzi had previously tweeted that NCIP was dead and gone, that it had just been decided at a board meeting the policy was no longer deemed appropriate by FFA and a new diversity and inclusion policy was currently being worked on. Northern New South Wales football, forever the most curmudgeonly and outdated of the member federations, and you know that's a crowded field, as we've seen, has decided that they need to enforce this lame duck policy that's no longer relevant, that FFA doesn't deem viable. And you know what the source of the commotion is over, Nick?
It's literally the smallest thing.
It's a 3-centimetre Italian flag on the back of Hamilton Azzurri's shirt collars. Can we also reinforce that Hamilton Azzurri are a State League 4 community club with a passionate bunch of supporters?
Probably the
so
best
passionate
fan
that
base
they sent
the
us
show,
some gear here. But they're being persecuted over a jersey that's not new. They've been wearing this jersey for, I believe, 18 months.
Yep.
How is it suddenly a problem now that they're advancing to the latter stages of their state's FFA Cup?
Why is it even a problem in the first place? That's what I don't get. Yeah. How is this, there talks about, segregating minorities and everything else, apparently, that this policy allows just to bring everyone together. You're secluding this just over the smallest thing, as you said, a 3-centimetre Italian flag. Why in God's name does it matter? It should even be a policy to begin with, NCIP, because in my opinion, it's totally baffling as to why it even exists. But look, Avondale copped it as well in the FFA Cup last year, so it's almost like it's becoming a constant. And I just don't agree with it, full stop. And it's got to go. I don't understand why it's even still around. We should be celebrating all the different migrants and ethnicities that this code has, obviously these ethnic backgrounds have helped bring this code up from the days of the NSL. And we're now saying, you can't celebrate it by literally saying you got to cover that up. And what are they going to wear on the weekend if they can't? Because there's been no clearances to that. So they're going to wear black tape over the back of it.
Like we saw with Avondale in the FFA Cup last season.
I don't get it.
It's ridiculous. I mean, we could go into the hypocrisies of it. We could go into the fact that Lambton Jaffers have Scottish, emblems on their crest, or Broadmeadow Magic have, Macedonian flag in the background. But I don't want to get into this name calling. You're allowed to do it, so why can't we?
Yeah.
That's besides the point.
It just shouldn't be. Why are we even wasting time on NCIP in the first place? Why is the FFA wasting time on it when they say it's not even a big matter? So why is it still going?
Yeah, it's ridiculous. I think it's up for debate as to whether NCIP is still in place. It seems that Northern New South Wales Football have taken it upon themselves to enforce their own policy on the matter, maybe inspired by a previous FFA policy. I'm sure when the new policy comes into effect nationwide, they will have no other choice but to allow these expressions of identity to actually be celebrated. But in the meantime, if you are a Northern New South Wales football person, please, get in touch with your representatives, write a letter, do whatever it takes to make your voice count. And when it comes to the next elections for the Northern New South Wales Football Board, have a look at the current composition, David Elland and co, and think about whether they're representing your football community in an appropriate way.
Well, if hashtag soccer Twitter could do anything about it, I'm sure they'd be at an instant and everything would be changed, because the outroar on social media has been absolutely unbelievable. Like, the effort from the players and the board of Hamilton Atsuri, they've gone over and above to promote this club, have a bit of fun at the same time. And, you know, this is a very passionate team that literally, they are a State League 4 team, but probably have one of the best fan bases in all of Australia, which is unbelievable. And it's just literally a bunch of mates who have gotten together, started something, and then it's just grown into this big thing that's even has us wearing their own merchandise. I literally wear this jumper everywhere. It's one of the most comfortable jumpers I think I've ever worn. And it's even made appearances on other code shows, as you alluded to yesterday. You saw on Facebook. So it's getting there. It's getting around. But look, let's now move on to the next
topic.
It's
time to stop agreeing.
Yes, let's go to the... Let's actually continue with our A-League discussion. And one of the big things that came out today was the rumours about Daniel Sturridge. Now, Murray Shaw came out on the Fox Sports Football podcast and said that his agents have offered him to the A-League. And there's apparently some sort of interest for him to come over and play in Australia. Mind you, he's 29 years of age, had an injury-riddled last 5 years of his career. And I don't think he's played that poorly this season when he's gotten his opportunities at Liverpool. But is he coming to the A-League? Or is this just another Andrea Pirlo to Avondale-esque, you know, name just thrown up because he could be a free agent?
I don't think he will, and I think Fox Sports have a history of trying to big up these foreign transfers, whereas, you know, maybe most of them don't have a hope in hell of actually happening. I think the more interesting question is, if this is legit, because we don't have any inside sources as far as I know, you haven't been in touch with Daniel Sturridge's agent this morning,
no,
have you,
no,
Nick?
No, no, no.
Would he be a good signing? And my answer is no.
No?
Because the guy can't get on the pitch. We've seen in Australia, European players coming over here, there's hard pitches, there's hot conditions, they get injured, there's lots of travel, sitting on flights. I think Daniel Sturridge needs to be kept in a ball of cotton wool to actually make it out onto the field at any one time. And I'm not sure Australian football, the physical, fast-paced league that it is really the best place for him. He's a wonderful talent. I'm sure he would dominate this league if he was fit. But I just think as soon as he came over here, for how many millions of dollars you'd have to spend out of the Fox Sports marquee fund to get him here, he'd probably get injured in the first week of the season and be out for the rest of it.
And you'd have to argue as well which club would be willing to fork out that sort of money. They were saying that Brisbane Roar would almost have a bit of pull because of Robbie Fowler coming over and having that Liverpool tie and everything else, that maybe they could have a chat to Sturridge and say, yeah, you know, you go over there and you play under a Liverpool legend, it might be something big, potentially something happening there. But I honestly think it would only be a good move if he did stay fit, as you did say, because I think if he stays fit, you can market the league around him as the marquee face, which would be probably one of the only pools to be a lifestyle in Australia, which, and to be honest, I think the only places which, if you want to market a lifestyle to a player like Daniel Sturridge and a person with that sort of calibre, you'd be looking at either a Melbourne or a Sydney team. Would a Melbourne or Sydney team, maybe other than the Melbourne Victory, be able to afford him at this point in time? Maybe Melbourne City. Sydney FC, I don't think they're going to budge with their marquees. There's been no signal of any change, I don't think. I think
CM De Jong might be moving on. That's one.
Maybe one. But then again, they don't need a striker at the moment with Adam Lafondre playing this well. Maybe to replace Alex Brosk. But then again, though, that's all to be weighed up. But for me, I think it would only be a good move, as you said, if he stayed fit. Because if he's not fit, then it's going to be a waste of so much money. But then again, though, if he is fit, like, he could end up breaking goal-scoring records down here, because I still think that he should be still playing in England. Or he's playing in England, but should next season, he should probably still be playing in the Premier League. I think there'd be teams that would actually want him and be prepared to offer more.
I think there is something we're not talking about here, and that's his mental state. I'm not sure if he has the confidence in his own body anymore. I mean, Jurgen Klopp has talked about it in press conferences, that with some players, is it a physical issue or is it a mental issue, that they just don't trust their body. They're not making the same decisions on the field. They're not using their footballing skills in the same way because they think they're going to get injured at any moment. And in Daniel Sturridge's case, he's probably right to think that. So I'm not sure if he's as effective a footballer as he once was. That being said, you know, I'd love to see him do that wiggly arms dance in front of the Gosford sauce bottles. It'd be priceless.
Well, that's if they don't get relegated after a season. But anyways, look, talking about that, because he has actually moved right down the pecking order at Liverpool. Like, he's not the number two striker anymore. Divock Origi is now the number two striker, because Jurgen Klopp has turned to the Belgian instead of his Englishman time and time again in games where he needs a goal, which it does sort of speak volumes as to where Sturridge is at the moment. We spoke about Robbie Fowler, but now it is...
We haven't spoken about
it. No, I touched on him very, very briefly. That he's here. We haven't had a chance to really go too much in depth about it on this show. We actually haven't even been able to touch it at all. So is it a good move or not? Because obviously he's extremely unproven. Like, we don't know what he's like as a manager. We heard that he's apparently picked up already an assistant from Blackpool. It came out today at the Blackpool Gazette reported that he's already picked up his first man. He's going to be his right-hand man. But is this the right move, yes or no?
I'm a little disappointed that there's no local coaches on staff. You know, likes of Warren Moon have been doing so well in NPL, Ben Kahn, as you say. I think they missed an opportunity here to maybe reconnect with the grassroots of Queensland football. Robbie Fowler could be the latest in a long line of high-profile English managers coming down here, you know, with
Terry Butcher.
Unenviable records or lack of experience and being found out. That being said, I don't want to write him off before he gets, you know, steps on the field. He's obviously got great football pedigree. That doesn't always translate to being a great manager, as we know. But he apparently did top his pro-licence course. And a lot of coaches in the A-League don't even have a pro-licence, I don't believe. I think an A-licence is probably the standard that you need to meet. But he doesn't have any experience outside of a brief stint as player manager of Wong Tong United when he was in Thailand, after his A-League spell. So it's impossible to have any record to judge him on, but you know, judging by the comments from the Liverpool football community who hold him so dear, you know, they call him God for goodness sake. Obviously, they've got a high opinion of him, and he has played at the top level. Let's give him a chance before we start saying this is another shambolic decision from the Bakri group. It's the ownership situation that gives me pause, as opposed to the managerial appointment. It's whether the Bakri group have the football knowledge and, you know, have the best interests of the club at heart, and whether they're going to invest in the playing squad, because it's not that long ago that they weren't paying the players on time. We had all those issues up there. They've got a new training base now. They need to rethink their recruitment strategy. I think they need a better director of football in charge because, you know, Craig Moore's no longer there. I think the higher echelons of the managerial, you know, structure, as opposed to just the coach, is going to be what defines Brisbane's next season.
Exactly right, because how can he perform as a coach if he doesn't have the players to do so? And you've seen the state of the Brisbane Roar squad at the moment. Half of them's in the medical room at the moment, and literally their top senior players just aren't up to scratch. They're either too old or just not fit. So there needs to be some sort of clean out. I think that they're young kids. They've got a nice bunch of young kids, NYL champions, but they need to get some senior bodies in who are not just going to stay fit, but also add on the field, because I think that Brisbane Roar, they do have a fan base, but they're just dormant at the moment. We speak about the Brisbane Roar were arguably one of, if not the best A-League team at that time, around, 2010 to about 2012 under Ange Postecoglou, won a title with Mike Mulvey in 2014 as well, and were a constant in the finals basically until this season. So it's almost like, well, if they can get some things going on the field, get some players in, they're going to be able to build this team back up. They'd be looking to get straight back to the finals next season, no question about it. But whether the backer group's going to invest in that and allow for Robbie Fowler to utilise these players to the best of their ability, big question marks. And the question that I want to ask is, which players will actually still be there next season? Because maybe barring some of those young guys and Dylan Wenzel-Halls and maybe some of those senior guys like a Jamie Young, who's going to actually stick around? Because the majority of these guys are on short-term contracts too.
One guy who may not be sticking around is Eric Boltiak. And I wanted to ask you, Nick, about his penalty yesterday.
He didn't mean that.
That's my question.
I've read your mind from a mile away, and I don't think he meant that. He said, I saw some Instagram DM that someone messaged him in French asking if you mean it, and he said he did mean it. There is no way he meant that. I think he went for the Panenka and then got a bit of Larker that just rolled along the ground.
I think he meant to fake the keeper to go to Boteak's left and then meant to slide it right. Maybe it was Panenka. I think he might have just been, you know, doing the big fake shot to the left and then just tucking it low. I think he mishit it. But I think there was some intention there to fake the keeper out and then, you know, place it nonchalantly into the other direction. Wasn't a great goalkeeping display. But
not at all.
Not at all. I think he got a little bit lucky because he mishit what he was trying. But I think there was some intention there.
Well, he's probably been the only bright spark. Him and Dylan Wenzel-Hall is probably the only bright sparks. What's been a really poor season for Brisbane. One they'd want to forget quickly. And I think that he'll end up probably somewhere else in the A-League next season. Rumours are the Melbourne Victory are interested. But he'll probably end up back in France, probably playing maybe for a lower league one team, because he's still quality. Like, he had a pretty good season.
I could see him going to Asia as well. He is a mercurial talent, and we've seen with guys like Besar Brisher. Granted, Brisher was a legend before he came to the Victory, but he, in that last season, remember his temper was getting the better of him. He got sent off, I think, a little bit unlucky on a couple of occasions, but sent off three or four times. Yeah. that year. And he came down to the victory. The fans didn't really know what to expect from him because he's such a volatile player. And Boateng has a bit of that about him. We've seen him going for absolute reducers on a number of players. I think Corey Brown had got on the wrong end of his studs earlier this season. I wonder if in a better situation with better players around him, he would maybe cool off a little bit and be able to channel that aggression and that competitive spirit in a more constructive way.
Yeah, well, I think that competitive spirit is there. As you do say, maybe it is just that frustration of not winning.
And
maybe
class. He's got a great touch.
He can finish.
He's got all of the attributes. I think it's more of a mental hurdle with him.
Of course.
And Kevin Muscat, for all his detractors, and I have been one on occasion, he's not a great tactician. He doesn't bring up the young players enough. I've criticised him on a number of occasions for various things, but he is a good man manager.
Yeah.
If he's in charge next season, I think Boateng is a player he could work with and improve.
He'd be a good player to add into that midfield as well, especially if KSK Honda does leave, which we do expect him to. He's almost a like-for-like replacement in terms of the similar sort of role that he does play. But just I honestly think that looking at just the Brisbane Roar in general, it's going to take a lot for them to get back to the finals. Just getting back on topic there, I just think that whether it is Robbie Fowler, who it's going to be, very similar situation with them and the Central Coast Mariners. They've just got to have the players on the field to do just that. Let's head over to Europe and another team, which one of our staff members here, Louise Taffer, said they definitely need a summer clean out.
And I think she said that she'd only keep three players
and one of those three players is more than likely to leave, and they would definitely not want to lose him. Manchester United have had almost a week from hell over the past. Their loss against Barcelona, smacked by Everton, lose the Manchester derby. Do they need a summer clean out? And who goes, who stays?
Manchester United need a director of football.
And not Warren Joyce.
Not Mike Phelan, who was touted as a possible appointment by Miguel Delaney, one of the journalists over there in England. And I actually DM'd Miguel just to give him a little bit of insight as to Mike Phelan's disastrous time at Central Coast Mariners. I don't know how much time he actually spent in Gosford, but he is still technically their director of football, and look how that's gone. They get offcuts.
So I always forget how Danny De Silva's still on loan from Central Coast as well.
De Silva's contract must be just like a mine of.
Do you think that
Drama
probably still have like a 5% ownership?
I think there's some
like
weird. I think that guy who used to own a bit of Carlos Tevez probably has a slice of Danny De Silva. What is his name? Kia Jurkabin or something
like that.
Manchester United have shown no direction in their transfers over a number of windows so far. They've had too many coaching changes, not the right appointment. I think they rushed into appointing Solskjaer when, if you look at the advanced stats, I know, nonsense, but they were way outperforming their expected goals over that run where they set an away wins record. Mm. And now it's sort of regressed even below the mean. So I think their real standard lies somewhere in between that great run of form and the current nightmare run they've been on. That being said, how are Chris Smalling and Phil Jones still
starting?
How did they get contract extensions?
Well, they're there till 2022 now. That's unbelievable.
Matteo Darmian hadn't played for 3 months. Why is he selected in the Manchester derby? Ashley Young is one of the senior players. How is he still there?
He's 33 now as well. He's way past his prime.
Fred seemed like he was playing for Manchester City, how often he passed to blue shirts. He was shocking in that position. And I don't see what they saw in him that they wanted to splash out 40, 50 million on him in the summer. Mm. So they do need reinforcements. And look at the City bench that was at the Manchester derby. Not including the goalkeeper, but all of those outfield players would start for Manchester United without question. Danilo, Sane, Mahrez, Otamendi, Jesus, Phil Foden. I think all of those players would start for Manchester United. Mate, so that just shows the golfing class.
Barring Muric, who's obviously...
Yeah, I said not the goalkeeper. Although with David De Gea's form at present, we have to think about it.
Lee Grant will be a better option than David De Gea the way he's playing at the moment. But touching on that about Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, do you think that United just benefited from the fact that... You know how when a new coach comes in, it just seems like the majority of teams...
Dead manager
just,
bounce.
Yeah, they just does that big bounce. And it's like that peak and then it's just the quick drop off. We've seen it with so many teams throughout the world. Just that Solskjaer was not proven before this. He had that bad run at Cardiff. Didn't really do much with Molde either. So, you look at it like this. This is a team that I think you can't really do much with and you can't expect to do much with, as you do say. I'm looking at the likes of Alexis Sanchez as well, which the experiment has really failed.
He's earning $500,000 a week if he can.
He's got to go. He's got to go.
How are they going to get rid of him, though? Well, no one's going to pay those wages.
The only team that somewhat will be able to pay those wages or from a league would be from China. Or maybe the MLS would have to fork out some big money, which would be maybe even half, not even half.
I don't think he's even an attractive proposition to those clubs anymore. So far, has his stock fallen so quickly?
He's a bit like Gonzalo Higuain at the moment. Very similar in terms of big money earners that just aren't at the same level they once were. I think Juan Mata as well needs to be moved on. As much as I have a very soft spot for Juan Mata, I've always loved how he's gone about it for Chelsea, even previously. Chris Smalling, no doubt about he's got to go. Don't even know why Lee Grant's at the club, full stop. No offence. Andreas Pereira, I think, even though he's still technically young, I think that might need to move on from that.
I think he's all right. I think you could keep him as a squad player for now and see how he develops. Paul Pogba gets so much unfair criticism, in my opinion.
Yeah, well, what do you expect him to do?
I think a lot of the criticism is about his haircut, his fashion sense, his attitude.
Yeah.
Nothing is based on his performance. And to be honest, I think a lot of that is tinged with just a little bit of racism.
Yeah,
a lot of the criticism that he receives. Obviously, he needs to perform better in big matches. He loses the ball too much. But can please the pundits in England, you know, Graham Souness, I'm looking squarely in your direction. Can you please keep the criticism professional and limit it to what he's displaying on the field rather than what he uploaded to Instagram? Because that's just not relevant.
So you look at this squad now as well. What positions do you think they should target? Because I think that definitely, if just to quickly add my 10 cents, it'd be definitely a right back, I think, because Antonio Valencia and Matteo Darmian need to be moved on. I think a centre back or two need to be looked at, because I don't mind Victor Lindelof. And look, Eric Bailly is still young. I think as a squad player, is a good player to bring in.
I think 20. Eric Bailly, if he had a better setup in front of him, because he had a great run under Mourinho.
At the start, it was fantastic,
so,
yeah.
I think United players, because of the supporter base is so wounded at the moment, they have one bad performance and then you write them off as a footballer. Bailly has been injury prone and he's had some bad games. I think you need to give him a second chance, because there was a run of games under Mourinho where he looked like the best centre-back the club had had in years.
Yeah.
And he has a bit of the rashness that maybe a young Nemanja Vidic had.
Yeah.
So he needs to temper that, and he dives in too early, but he can be, with that coolness of Lindelof, a little bit of a, you know, Ferdinand Vidic kind of combination.
Yeah, I do agree with that, but I still think as well, on top of that, they do need to bring in reinforcements.
They need another centre-back.
Because Phil Jones and Chris Smalling are not going to cut it, especially in the Champions League environment. I think they do need to bring in another central midfielder as well to partner Paul Pogba. I'm not sure about Nemanja Matic and co. I think that they do definitely need to bring someone in there. And I think they need to bring in maybe another striker. I don't know about Romelu Lukaku. I'm going out and saying it. I just think that they could do better than that. There aren't many options available. But I genuinely think that Lukaku has not lived up to what the expectations would be. Marcus Rashford, Anthony Martial, you need to build that attack around them too and bring someone else in. I'm looking squarely at Luka Jovic as a guy they could bring in to potentially build their attack around with those two as well. Because them three would form a very formidable, whether it's a front three, a front two, whatever it might be, that is something you can market around, something you could definitely build around for the future.
I think the striker, out of the positions you've listed, is the last priority for me. If you have a more competent team, then you can set up a front three around Rashford, Lingard, Martial, those kinds of players.
We always forget about Jesse Lingard.
Yeah, Lingard is a much better footballer than a lot of people give him credit for. Juan Mata hasn't had a look in. He might move on, but I still think in certain Premier League games against smaller opposition, when they're sitting at the edge of their own box, Juan Mata is a guy who can find the final
30
pass.
30 years old now, you could probably get a decent sum from a La Liga team for maybe about 20 million.
I don't think he's the first guy out the door.
No, there's definitely plenty more.
I think the holding midfield position has never been filled in an adequate way. I think right back is a huge problem, and a centre back. And those are the three I would be targeting in the offseason.
So what happens to Fred?
I think Fred, I mean, he's only just arrived at the club for one season, maybe daunted by, you know, all the stuff that's gone on. I think you persist with him as a squad player and, you know, he needs coaching, obviously. He showed ability at Shakhtar Donetsk. I mean, maybe not, you know, 40, 50 million transfer fee ability, but he has ability nonetheless, and he's still young. So I would persist with him in the squad. I think selling him after one season is a knee-jerk. And there are other players in the squad who should be offloaded before him.
Well, looking as well at some of the young players they've got in their academy, I think that maybe next season they should probably, this might even be a bit rash, but I'd like to see more minutes into the likes of Angel Gomez, Tahith Chong, and also Mason Greenwood, because I think that they are much better options. Even these last few games, if Champions League comes out of the discussion, and this will actually segue perfectly into our next question, but maybe it should be that these guys get a crack. Because against PSG and in those games where they were hit with injuries, they did an all right job. And I definitely think that they could be used. I think as well, Timothy Fosu-Mensah might be looked at to potentially
come
fill,
back from
Fulham. Yeah. And also Axel Twansby as well, who's at Aston Villa. So they're two guys they could definitely use as defensive players.
I don't like Scott McTominay. I'm sorry. I don't.
He's had a couple good games recently.
The only reason Scott McTominay exists in the United
lineup is Jose Mourinho.
Is Jose Mourinho trying to prove a point to Paul Pogba. He's like, well, you know, you've got all the ability, but I'm going to play this guy instead because he works hard. McTominay, he's going to be sold to Burnley in 2 years. He's not a long-term option.
He has played a couple of good games recently, but in my opinion, he's probably going to end up being like, I don't want to sound too rash, but he's probably going to be like a Darren Gibson, like in terms of same sort of player. Like, hopefully we don't end up, he ends up in the same sort of career that Darren Gibson's had, where he's had injuries and all those other off-field issues. But in terms of a similar player and similar career path, it could very much be the same. They take on Chelsea this weekend, who are also, at the moment, in a very, very odd position. They're in a Europa League semi, but at the same time, their form in the league has been stuttering. A 2-2 draw with Burnley on the weekend. Who has more to lose from this game? Because United basically need a win to stay in touch, but Chelsea win, they get just that little bit closer to a Champions League position.
I think Chelsea have more to lose because they've got the lead, and also they're going to be facing potential transfer ban next season for some goings on in the background that, you know, weren't so savoury from the club. So it's going to be very hard for them to bring in reinforcements, and they're already looking, you know, potentially losing the likes of Eden Hazard in the off-season. Real Madrid will come in for him, no question about it. So I think they really need to qualify for the Champions League to keep the players that they've got happy. With United, I mean, I think the players have a lot to lose because they all have, you know, clauses in the contracts that they lose 20-25% of their wages if they don't qualify for the Champions League. But as a club, it might be the best thing for them to focus on the league, to try and, you know, overhaul the squad and fix things in the back room, because at the moment they've got people running the show who, you know, don't know a lick about football.
And to be honest, I could see this game ending in the most dull draw possible. Like, I just think that that's the way it's going to end up. I think that if this transfer ban does come in, I'm actually looking at the moment at the plethora of players. The plethora is not even does justice the amount of players they have out on loan at the moment, because you look at some of these guys that genuinely could come in and do something for them. Like, Christian Pulisic will come in next season. I think it's obviously the pick of the bunch. And I think if Hazard does move on, he's not a bad replacement. Obviously, you can't really barely any players in the world can replace the quality of Eden Hazard. But Pulisic is still young, can add something. I'm looking at as well at the likes of, there's one guy that I know this is typical, pulling at the heartstrings for me with Wigan, but Reece James. Now, I don't know if many have actually seen Reece James play at all this season, but he hadn't played a senior game before this year. He's played all 44 games, starting as a right back into centre mid, got named in the championship team of the season, only 19 years of age. And this guy, I'm telling you, I have not seen a 19-year-old boss the midfield like this in the championship ever. This guy, I'm telling you, in a couple seasons, don't be surprised to see him play for England. He is an absolute bull. He can score free kicks as well. He scores goals. He's defensively proficient. He can pass the ball. He's almost like, I don't want to go out and say, but he's almost like a complete player. And I think if I was Chelsea, I'd be considering actually getting him into the squad next season, or he has to at least be playing in the Prem, or maybe Wigan can sign him permanently, which I'd love personally. But honestly, he's one of those other guys. But you've got the likes of, as well, Kurt Zouma, Victor Moses as well, isn't really
there. This is some Wikipedia page, by the way.
Mario Pasalic, you've got Mishi Bashuai, Tammy Abraham, Mason Mount, Lewis Baker, there's Ola Aina, Michael Hector, Matt Miazga. Baba Rahman's apparently still around there. Kenneth Omiero. They've got a whole range of just players that just go unnoticed, and players are just unbelievable still on the books there.
It's a weird strategy that they've employed. I think it's a money-making scheme. You know, I think Vitesse Arnhem and can't believe their luck as a Chelsea farm club. I think they can bring in a few of these players to add depth. They're not going to be difference makers, though, a lot of them.
Well, Callum Hudson-Odoi is probably going to be moved on. But if Hazard does get sold and they can't really buy anyone else, would you just lock him in as that left wing to play almost every game next season? Because obviously Willian and Pedro, your natural right-sided players, and so is Pulisic. So it almost makes sense for Hudson-Odoi to make that natural progression. And he's young and he's got all the ability in the world and all the potential in the world.
It's funny because as soon as Bayern Munich started showing an interest in him, Chelsea are sitting up and thinking, well, actually, maybe this guy should be playing. even though he's been under their noses the entire time. I couldn't agree more. I think he should be starting plenty of games next season. You know, I think he should be starting 30 games, and especially if Hazard moves on, because he is an unbelievable talent. And if they let him slip through their fingers while holding on to all of these lone players that, you know, aren't going to be difference makers, I think that's a crazy, crazy call.
Well, it all remains to be seen, because he actually did his Achilles tendon the other day, so it's more a question of whether he'll be fit at all next season. Let's go back to Australia, and Mark Bosnich the other day was talking about the Asian Champions League and about Australian teams trying to play out from the back. Was he right?
Well, this was the example he used was in the Guangzhou game on Tuesday, where Lawrence Thomas played the ball out to his defender, I think it was Deng, played it to Corey Brown, and Corey Brown, the much maligned left back.
Your mate.
He played one of the worst first-time passes I've ever seen in my entire life. Tried to play it with the outside of his foot for some reason, stabbed at it, and it curved several metres off its intended target, which was an open midfield player. This was a woeful example to use if Bozza was trying to make this point.
Yeah.
Because if Corey Brown could pass a ball, and he's been consistently terrible all season with his decision-making under pressure, with his passing, just his technical level has just not been up to scratch, and he consistently puts his teammates under pressure. If he could have made that 5-metre pass to an open player, Melbourne Victory would have sucked in 5 Guangzhou players, been able to turn and play out the other side. And that's one of the most crucial skills in modern football, is to be able to play through the press when prudent. Obviously, you can't play out from the back every single time.
No.
And you do have to hoof it on occasion when you get into a jam. But encouraging teams to abandon, you know, what's been the attempted, maybe not well implemented, but attempted national curriculum over the last sort of decade or so, I think is very short-sighted. And Bozza, as usual, is sort of playing to the peanut gallery and being a populist, which I don't think is constructive for Australian football.
But also at the same time, though, Melbourne Victory did play quite well with their tactics weren't necessarily great, but easily could have won that game. Like, I don't believe that giving away possession by playing a long ball or trying to bomb it away is constructive at all. Only if you're defending a lead late on when it's you're up by a goal in a game like that. But if you're in the middle of a game where it's a draw, why abandon? Why decide, you know, something that's actually been working not too bad in the league and you've got players who are technically able to do it, keep it up. Because obviously, as you said, you make that pass, you make that turn, you get over to the right, you could potentially create a goal-scoring opportunity. And the thing is, what is unfortunate, because of this system that Muskie plays, you do need pretty technical fullbacks who get up the field and able to connect with your midfielders. Unfortunately, Corey Brown is not as technically proficient as maybe what a Michael Zullo is or a Ryan Grant for Sydney FC.
Daniel Georgievsky used
exactly
to be
right. So what do you want them to do about it? Like, at the end of the day, I feel like it's very rash. I feel like it's almost, one example, let's just immediately cross it off.
And I think it's a bit of an agenda at play here as well, because it sort of cuts at the heart of the central divide in Australian football between, you know, the Ange Postecoglou acolytes, of whom I consider myself among those.
Yeah.
You know, I don't back every decision he made in charge of the national team. And also, you know, the big crowd at Fox Sports who really, in a lot of ways, white-anted Ange Postecoglou out of that
job. Remember during the 2018 World Cup qualifiers when Australia were having those games against Thailand when they weren't playing at their best, and literally the criticism that Ange was copping was through the roof at one point. And it was unbelievable because, look, we don't want to segue too much from it, but it does still, it is still quite relevant, because at the end of the day, this soccer has still got to the World Cup and they still weren't playing terribly. They did have that game against Thailand where they drew 2-2 in very trying conditions. And you have to take into context what Thailand were as a country on the back of, and they were very much up for that game. And I think to a degree as well, us as the Australian football community at the time probably disrespected how Thailand were in the sort of football. The people who underrated, because now they're not viewed in the same minnow fashion that maybe they once were after what they've been able to do and some of the players they've been able to unearth over the past year and a bit. So for me personally, look, don't abandon what is working. That's as simple as that. Like, look, at the end of the day, these players are getting a fantastic opportunity to play against some of the best teams in Asia. And look, if they lost that game, they weren't going to qualify anyway. So it's an opportunity for players to develop. And obviously, some of those young kids got that opportunity to play against your Anderson Taliscas and your Paulinhos. It's a great, great little bit of baptism of fire for them, I thought, as well.
Yeah, do you think it was a correct decision from Muscat to make so many changes, especially on the bench for that game?
I think there were too many under-18s maybe on the bench, especially if you're not going to play them. Like, if you're only going to play Jack Palazzolo, like, why not play them all if they're all going to be there? Like, I thought maybe they could have kept a few of those senior guys out there. They don't have anything to play for this weekend against Western Sydney Wanderers. Why not go for the win at the end of the day? Like, I know it's good to get some of these young kids out there, but even if they just played maybe Ola Toivonen or Keisuke Honda in that game, it would have just at least given them a chance to maybe win. Like, obviously, with the don't disrespect to the players that played the other day. Like, they did a good job because, mind you, they were really up against it and they almost won that game. Probably should have had Kenny Athew scored that goal at the end. So, look, end of the day, they're not going through. These next two games are literally just going to be shoehorned in between these A-League finals and they're probably going to be doing something very similar. I know there's a rule in the AFC that you can't rest everyone, but those Jai Inghams and your Kenny Athews and Anthony Lesiotis and Josh Hope will probably start all those games.
Jai Ingham loves this competition.
He should have an Asian Champions League-only contract, I believe, because he is becoming that sort of player. Let's now go back to Europe, and one team that got a big win was Wolves against Arsenal. Mm. Now, can they realistically become a top four contender next year?
With the money that's behind them, I think the sky's the limit for Wolves. I think it's difficult to challenge that top six. Everton have tried to, maybe haven't spent the money in the right way, and they've paid the price for that.
Bought some pretty ordinary, well, players that looked good on paper, but when they got to the Prem, didn't adjust in the way they would have liked, and or players didn't necessarily.
The puzzle pieces didn't quite fit.
No.
And, you know, they've still had a decent season, they're ninth, but given the immense spending in the off-season, you know, that didn't match expectations. Wolves, on the other hand, have a very clear strategy of the way they want to play. It's counter-attacking, it's pressing in moments. They have that sort of 3-4-3 system that they
use.
It's
like a bit of a 3-5-2 in a way. Yeah,
it kind of varies a little bit. I think with the right reinforcements, and, you know, they've got great connections agent-wise. Jorge Mendes seems to be basically their director of football. But he has so many connections in Portuguese football in particular. Mm. He can unearth these players and get them for relatively cheap, whereas other clubs might be paying, you know, 10, 15 million more. So I think the sky's the limit for Wolves. They play in a way that, you know, other Premier League teams don't with those wing-backs. They overload. They, you know, the likes of Mac Doherty have been, you know, revelations this season. I think with a few defensive reinforcements, perhaps, I think maybe they've lacked a little bit of mobility across that back three and maybe a game changer in midfield or attack. To make the difference against the very top sides, I think they could be a top four contender next season.
I think the way to describe it as well with their team, they've got a very, very good base. Mm. They've got a fantastic base to work with Jota, Moutinho, Neves, Dendoka, Doherty, Bolly, Jimenez. The list goes on of players they've got it's a Premier League mid-table team at the moment that's pushing that next level. It's around your West Hams and your Evertons. But you did say if they do bring in some real quality players, potentially in that defence and maybe in some other positions, there's no reason why they can't at least be a Europa League team. I think it's going to be very hard for them to get to fourth because I think that Arsenal next year, now that you've of Unai Emery, maybe some more reinforcements will definitely be up there because I like what Unai Emery is putting in place at Arsenal. Mm. I just don't think he has the squad just yet. And I just think Liverpool, Man City, even Tottenham are going to be just a bit too far ahead. So I think around that area of maybe fifth to around ninth is probably about right for Wolves because not many teams have made the jump from the Championships to the Prem to this same sort of level because their team, even the Championship last season, was absolutely immense. Like, who is going to have Ruben Neves, one of the best young talents in the world, playing in the Championship? If they've got the money to spend, they bring in some more quality players. Look, they could have a bit of a run. Anything can happen in the Prem. Like, we must not forget, Leicester did win the league 3 years ago. So it would be interesting to see what happens with
things will have to fall their way. There has to be some high-profile injuries for the teams that they're up against. You know, you can't. I mean, Leicester won the league, but that was such a confluence of events. You know, the rest of the top teams were in a downturn. So you have to have things go your way. But they're a team who can score three goals while having 25% of possession, and that's a powerful thing.
Let's now discuss the title race because it took another turn in midweek with Man City's 2-0 win. It has made it's heartbreaking for Liverpool because they have done everything right this season. They are going to have a season better than the Invincibles of 2004 and they yet could not win the league, which is almost, I'm going to say, peak Liverpool. Is it over? Because I look at City's last three games against Burnley, Leicester and Brighton and it's so hard to pick them dropping any points, considering that Leicester's a team that's had the wood over them, but it's at the Etihad where Man City have been fantastic all year. Is there any hope?
Liverpool have the Champions League semi-finals against Barcelona as well to contend with, so it's not going to be easy. Manchester City, they're in a run of form where in the Premier League where you think they look almost unbeatable. In the Champions League, Pep Guardiola's neurosis seems to play tricks on his mind. But in the league setting, although Pep Guardiola hasn't won a close title race in quite some time.
No.
So, you know, this will test him as well. Look at the three teams Man City are playing, Burnley, Leicester and Brighton. Now, they're not high on the table, but Burnley can cause City problems with their physicality. Ashley Barnes, you know, Sean Dyche, it's going away to Burnley as well. It's the kind of game that Manchester City don't like.
It's going to be interesting, but Burnley have not beaten Man City. I did some reading the other day in their last six or seven games, and it's been almost smashings every time. So that's going to be the tough thing.
But you can see a one-off game. Maybe the shots don't go in. City start getting nervous, and then Burnley get a corner in the 87th minute. And so I can see Burnley doing something here. I don't think they'll win, but it could possibly be a draw just because that they will bring that physicality. Leicester, obviously Brendan Rodgers with a bit of a point to prove. You've got big slabhead Harry Maguire coming up for corners. I think City are weak on set
pieces. Still got Mr. Jamie Vardy as well.
Exactly. They've got some good players in their team. And then Brighton, you know, they'll be fighting for survival on the very last day of the season.
Well, that all depends still. That all still depends, but that
probably
is, yeah.
They're the one team that's involved in that relegation battle. So they'll have something to play for, which is a very important aspect of this. If I was Jurgen Klopp and this title race has been very respectful. It's been all niceties. Oh, you play such great football. No, Pep, you play such great football. What you need to do, that's exactly what Manchester City want. That's exactly what
Pep... Get a bit of biff.
Jose Mourinho drove Pep Guardiola insane when he was at Real Madrid. You need to get inside his head, not only when the two teams are playing each other, but every week. It doesn't hurt to throw in a little barbed
and
comment
Jurgen Klopp,
about...
he's not afraid to throw a jab when needed.
Exactly. He's a big man. He's got a big Cheshire Cat smile. He can get away with a few things in press conferences.
He just has to put a smile on when he says it, and then he won't even get fined by the FA, and Pep Guardiola won't even take it to heart, but it might rattle him just a little bit.
You've got to rattle your rivals, and I think that's what Liverpool need to do, because you know if they can't take the moral high road anymore, you've got to start putting doubts in Pep Guardiola's mind, and then he might start to overthink things.
Burnley actually have not lost in their last four games, so that does go in their favour. They've got a bit of momentum. Leicester, on the other hand, well, Brendan Rodgers has done okay. And as you did say, point to prove, because he was the manager of that infamous slip in 2014. So maybe there's a bit of an agenda almost in a way. Not an agenda, but like sort of just a bit of, I want to get one up on them, because obviously of what happened in 2014 was...
Are you saying Brendan Rodgers might have an ego?
They played with good character, all right? But yeah, in that instance, Brighton as well could come out. Obviously, relegation battle, anything can happen. It's at home as well in that final day.
And that Kevin De Bruyne injury could be important as well.
Of course. But, and then again, though, if Matty Ryan has a good day, and we're hoping that Matty Ryan always has a good day for Brighton. Brighton have been on a bit of a bad run of form. But then again, though, they have shown in the past that they can threaten and they can be a team to cause some headaches. Liverpool, on the other hand, Huddersfield at home, they'll probably win that. Newcastle away. Up against Rafa, maybe Rafa will do a bit of a favour. They're safe, Newcastle, at the moment. Then Wolves on the final day, which could be interesting.
He still loves Liverpool, Rafa.
Wolves at Anfield on the final day could be interesting, only because Wolves could technically still be fighting for a Europa League spot if seventh becomes available.
And I think they're the kind of team who will be important to them as their progression to the club. Some clubs could take or leave a Europa League spot, but I think Wolves will want it.
Let's go to the relegation battle. We touched on Brighton for a second. They don't take on Cardiff, but they're taking on Cardiff in this relegation battle. Who stays up?
Cardiff or Brighton? I can't wait to see the back of Cardiff City in this Premier League. I think they're one of the worst, most negative teams.
What about Neil Warnock? He's great value.
And Neil Warnock he does love Brexit, and he's not afraid to say it. I think the Premier League is an inclusive, multicultural competition can do without Neil Warnock. I think the fourth officials of the Premier League can do without Neil Warnock.
Well, the referees, when he comes up there and he just stands and gives them the cold shoulder, just looking at him like this after a loss.
Neil Warnock, for someone who is, you know, such a proud Englishman, has such a victim's mentality. He just makes me sick. I can't wait to see the back of Cardiff City. They are going down, and the most likable man in English football, Chris Hughton, is staying up.
Well, Brighton do have a bit of an easier run. Well, actually, not really. Sorry, I've just misinterpreted. Cardiff have got the easier run. They got Fulham and Crystal Palace before Manchester United in the final day. Brighton have Newcastle at home, Arsenal away, Man City on the final day. They can get a win against Newcastle, I reckon they're safe because that's probably going to be that bit of enough. And also they've got the goal difference on Cardiff. I think Brighton will stay up. I think Cardiff, they're your perennial championship team. Sorry to say it, but I think that they're going to go down.
And Warnock is a championship manager. He's not a Premier League manager.
I'm surprised he's stuck around this long. I'm so surprised. I honestly thought by January he would have been done, because he's your Sam Allardyce mould manager of comes in, fixes your club up for a few months, and then he's out the door. Let's come back to Australia. Now, you look at Wellington and Adelaide, they're more than likely, barring an absolute miracle happens between Melbourne City getting a win and Perth giving a big win to Wellington, they're more than likely going to rest players. But who can cause more damage? We know it's more than likely to be Adelaide hosting this finals. Well, it will be Adelaide hosting this final. Which team can, if they were to get to that semi-final, who can actually potentially beat Perth Glory? Because if they do win, they will be taking on the Glory.
I think it's the Phoenix. I know it's a long way trip. It's the distance derby. But just that Mark Redan factor. I think he can come up with a plan to beat teams. I've been so impressed with Mark Redan. I've seen him play firsthand against Melbourne Victory. His teams play twice this season. They got a draw both times. They were both times unlucky, but they pinpointed the opposition's weaknesses and attacked them mercilessly. I really like this Wellington Phoenix team. I think Adelaide under Marco Kurz, yeah, they're on a good run. Since he, it was announced that he was leaving, maybe they want to do something for their outgoing manager. But I think they have a ceiling the way they play. Mm. Baba Diawara scoring a goal on the weekend.
We'll probably get injured again.
There's no falser adorn than Baba Diawara coming off the bench and scoring in an almost dead rubber game.
Imagine if Baba Diawara turns out to be some sort of difference maker and like leads Adelaide United to a grand final.
Well, he is their marquee player, so anything can happen.
I still can't believe that. I totally forgot about him. When I saw him in the Inns the other day, I'm like, does this guy still exist? Like, genuinely.
There's one thing that is certain, and that is Geordie Thomason will no longer see any minutes in an Adelaide United jersey because he has been one of the most useless signings.
And Apostolos Stamatsoulopoulos is back, and so is George Blackwood scored a couple of weeks ago. I think that it will be... this is tough. I don't think either of the teams will beat Perth if they get there.
No, they do.
I don't think so. It could be Sydney barring Melbourne Victory collapse against Melbourne City.
Popovich does seem to get the wobbles in the finals.
But he usually saves it in the grand final day. He tends to pull out miracles on semi-final day and get his team down by three goals and then pull off an amazing win. I just think that if it was going to be anyone I'd have to pick would be Wellington's beautiful attack. If Singh, Krishna and Williams get going, I think that they could cause a lot of damage. It really depends as well because you have to take in the travel factor as well. Wellington going to Perth already this season, they got smacked. It'll be interesting to see what happens this weekend, but don't read too much into it. It more depends on who plays for both teams because it could be a game where Wellington go, all right, we've got the big travel, got to potentially go back to Adelaide. And will they go back to Wellington then go to Adelaide? Like that's another thing to weigh up because will they decide maybe will they just going to rest players? Will Nathan Burns be brought back out of the wilderness for this game? Maybe so. Interesting little parameter, but I don't think either of those teams will really cause any damage. But if anything, it will be Wellington. Melbourne City is set to finish sixth, barring a massive win tonight against the Mariners and a big loss for Wellington. Is it a good thing? Because they have had surprisingly the wood on Melbourne Victory, beat them in round one and two scrappy draws. Can they? If they get to six, could they cause one of the most, I'm going to say it'd be the biggest party pooper result out there because they have not played attractive football by any stretch. And in my opinion, I don't want to see them there because I just don't think that they've been good at all this season. But is it a good thing?
For them to play in a derby? Wow. They do get up for the derbies, but it's usually the regular season that they've met. I don't think it is. I think they would have liked to play a worse team and they could scrape a result. Maybe Jamie McLaren scores a goal and they go through. I think Melbourne Victory will rise to the occasion and beat them this time. I know they haven't beaten them this season, but I really do think Victory are a better big game team. They're just a better team full stop. They've got meta quality throughout the squad. They play better football. I just think City, maybe they can get up for their grand final every season, the three games that they play against Victory in the regular season. But once it comes to finals time, then they're a club with virtually no silverware. You can't have an FFA Cup amongst it. But they haven't performed well in high-pressure games. And I think, the prospect of this manager staying on is not going to be a carrot for any player to deliver a game-changing performance.
Look, the only player for me, if I was Melbourne Victory, to be somewhat worried about would be like if the Jamie McLaren factor, because he's a big game player, and potentially Bart Schenkeveld and Richie Delight at the back. I just think, other than that, they haven't really got any other weapons. I think Victory...
Ryan McGree is a weapon, and he showed that against Wellington
in
recently.
The middle of the park. But you look at the Victory, what they've got all around the pitch, they've got too much quality. I think if Honda and Toivonen are on in itself is enough for them to win this game, and you've still got to take in Costa Barbarous, so I think it's been one of the unheralded stars this season in the A-League. I honestly think, though, because you look at how they've matched up previously, I think they've only played one final against each other back in 2015 where Victory beat them 3-0 in a semi. I think that just because City, when they get to the finals, it seemed like they have not been able to get past the hurdle of being, if it's a semi-final the first round, I think Victory will get the job done. If it's rocking at Amy Park that night, there is no way I could see Melbourne City winning that game. Because in my opinion, I don't want to sound too harsh, but I think they're just filling the numbers there.
Yeah, and I think Victory will be resting players in the Champions League as well. So yeah, they won't have that that hurdle to get over.
All those somewhat injured bodies probably won't even play this weekend either. I can't even see him playing.
Can we talk about what's going on with Lawrence Thomas?
I think he's gone.
Yeah?
I think he's gone. I did an article a few months ago for the Herald Sun with myself and David Davidovich about Lawrence Thomas, and he did say he has ambitions to push himself and go to that next level and go overseas. I think he's gone overseas. I think he's already got an offer. I reckon that it's done. I think that he has to play in finals, though. I think if you're going to freeze him out, I don't think that this is the right time. Maybe against the Wanderers, yeah, play Matt Acton. And Matt Acton's done a good job. But Lawrence Thomas is arguably the best goalkeeper in the A-League. If not, he is the best goalkeeper in the A-League. So for me to take him out in finals could be absolutely detrimental. But I think he's gone.
Yeah, look, there's been rumours swirling around for ages. We thought he was going to leave to Japan before the end of the transfer window.
I don't think he's going to Asia, though. I reckon he's going to Europe.
Europe, okay.
I reckon he's going to Europe.
I do wonder whether the club... it's sort of a boy who cried wolf situation, because Melbourne Victory, we know they finagle player injuries and don't tell the media anything about them. There's always stuff going on in the background. They keep it under wraps all the time. You know, they're like covert ops, Melbourne Victory's press department. They don't let anything slip. So I think perhaps this is a real injury, because he had strapping on his knee against Guangzhou.
I don't doubt it, but I reckon he's gone anyway.
Well, possibly. But I think the club has maybe been misinterpreted here. Maybe this is just an honest, you know, troublesome niggling injury he's trying to get over. Maybe re-aggravated it against Guangzhou and he's missing a week before finals for precisely that reason. I'm not sure if that's connected to the fact that he might depart. I think he might depart anyway, but you know, there's a lot of Victory supporters I've seen on Twitter today saying this is basically a smokescreen for his exit, and I think that's maybe a little bit unfair, but you can forgive them for thinking that given the club's record in the past on these matters.
Exactly right, and you have to think about the likes of Georgievsky, who left the club, and some of those other players that, you know, they did know they were leaving, and there's been players you can rattle off a whole heap of them. Keisuke Honda's all but walked out the door without actually saying he's leaving. So that's
and he was always going to stay for one season.
Exactly. So it's interesting, but I honestly think personally he won't be at the Melbourne Victory next season. I just think that based off his own ambitions as a footballer, I think that his ambitions are overseas.
And I think that's probably the right decision for him. I think he's done all he can in the A-League. He's won a Joe Marston medal. He's won a grand final for Melbourne
Kicked
Victory.
Kicked in the head in that bloody game
as
well.
He's inspirational performance for many, many reasons. I think he's hit the A-League ceiling and he needs to explore options overseas. And I wouldn't begrudge him for a second as a Melbourne Victory fan.
Let's go back overseas and let's talk Champions League. We won't have a chance to talk about it before these two semi-finals. Tottenham take on Ajax. Interesting game at the new White Hart Lane. This will be played at Tottenham and Ajax, the two underdogs of the Champions League. This could really go either way. And I'm going to go out and say it. I reckon that Ajax is going to continue it. I reckon they might not win this game, but I reckon they're definitely... But on the road, they've had this thing about playing on the road, haven't they? Juve and Madrid, they won both those games. I just think that they're going to go past Tottenham and they're going to be putting themselves right in the final.
This is a rare moment when you see a team like this at a club like Ajax, who's so financially limited. I mean, and they're not just financially limited. They have had money that they haven't spent in the past from, you know, sales of young players constantly. But they're also limited just by the league that they play in, the Eredivisie.
Yeah, it's not much of a pull to go play in the Eredivisie.
No, it's not a top-tier competition. So I think this side will be virtually dismantled. In three transfer windows' time, it will be totally unrecognisable, much like Monaco.
Yep.
But Tottenham, they do have a ability to play spoiler. And the form that that Heung-min Son is in, I think he can potentially replace Harry Kane up front.
I think he can as well. I think he's a
Harry Kane is an important player for Tottenham, no question. He's one of the best goal scorers in the world. But Son has gone to another level recently, and he can be not just a complimentary player in a top team, but he can be the man in big games. So that's what gives me pause, is just saying it's going to be the Ajax juggernaut.
Both strikers for these two teams, I think, are two of the most versatile and well-rounded strikers. They're actually not proper number nines. Dusan Tadic was a typical number 10 who's been reinvented into this new striker, but he adds so much more to his game than just scoring goals. He sets up for the other players around him. When you've got Van de Beek, Ziyech, Neres, you look at with Heung-min Son, he is very versatile as well. Like, Harry Kane is just stock standard number nine. Son can get around the field. He can whip balls in as well. He can provide for other players. This is going to be a very intriguing battle, but I just think the way the script is going, it's going to set up for Ajax to be in this final. And you did say it's going to be unrecognisable. There are going to be a lot of players that do leave. Matty De Ligt, Donny van den Beek, Frankie de Jong's already off. I think Dusan Tadic potentially could be off again. There are going to be clubs looking at him. I know that already AC Milan want to sign him. There's going to be players that will leave. And I just think, though, that they're going to get the best out of this team. This is it. This is Ajax's best chance to win the Champions League in a very long time. This is a historically successful club. I think they've got not just the backing of Ajax, but the backing almost of Holland in this situation, the backing of the broader football community. Everyone likes to get behind the underdog. Let's see what happens. I can't wait for this tie. And the other one, Liverpool-Barca. It almost seems for some that it's a sure thing that Barcelona are going to win this game, but I don't think it's that I don't think it's that straightforward. I think it's a bit more complex than that.
Barcelona are a great defensive team that don't get the credit for it because that's not how they brand their club. Mm. Their defensive record this season has been unbelievable.
Yeah.
Longley has been a great find. They've still got Umtiti on the sidelines. You know,
the constant of Gerard Piqué defense alongside him.
Gerard Piqué does a lot of those old-fashioned, hard-nosed centre-back things, but because we have this image of him as so much outside of football, you know, he's
Shakira's husband.
Shakira's husband, a Catalan activist, you know, so many ways that he's, you know, such a an icon for other reasons. He doesn't really get the credit he deserves. Also, people see him as this languid, you know, footballer who's so good on the ball, and he is. But he does things, you know, you saw against Manchester United, the last-ditch defending that he can pull off, he's really quite something else. So I think for defensive reasons, rather than, you know, obviously Messi is the alpha and omega of Barcelona, but because of their defensive setup, I think they will win this tie, and that will be the crux, rather than, you know, the beautiful football and so forth, because they've lost their religion in some ways. They have gone away from the traditional Cruyffian ideals. It's really Ajax that have exhibited that kind of those kinds of characteristics in the Champions League season. Barcelona can manage games, and that's why they're going to win.
Well, it's a different Barcelona team under Valverde we've noticed over the past almost two seasons now, and I think that they will win this tie, but I just think that if Liverpool can get an away goal, it's going to make things interesting in that second leg, because at Anfield, Liverpool have been absolutely unreal this season. But what I want to pose to you is, have Barca this season, because Real Madrid's attack is not what it used to be. Atletico's attack is not what it used to be. You've got Antoine Griezmann and Diego Costa, who's been way out of form. This is arguably the best attack in the world they're coming up against. So it'll be their greatest test for this defence. Can they potentially curb Salah, Mane and Bobby Firmino and even the likes of Shaqiri and Co coming off the bench?
Yeah, look, I think Liverpool, they're a great team to watch, of course. And Bobby Firmino is the key for them, the way he creates space. They have great attacking players. I wonder whether their midfield can keep up with Barcelona, though.
That's
Fabinho
really
and Naby Keita, they've been sort of mixed.
Gini Wijnaldum's been fantastic this
year. Gini Wijnaldum's been great. Milner is, we all know what James Milner does.
We all know what Jordan Henderson does as well.
Yeah. Jordan Henderson has been pretty good recently. He's been moved into a more shuttling number eight role, which I think suits his characteristics better than having to sit behind play and read play, because I think he's a bit of a, you know, his passing is a little bit conservative when he's in that role. When he can play a little bit more of an all-action box-to-box role, he's a little bit more effective, you know. But they're just not on the same level as Barcelona's midfield. Ivan Rakitic, one of the most underrated players in all of football, I still don't think, you know, Liverpool have the cattle to take on Barcelona now.
Going to be very interesting to see how that all plays out. Quick touch on the Europa League. We have big ties: Arsenal, Valencia, Chelsea, Eintracht Frankfurt. I'm going to say it's going to be an all-English final.
Yeah, I think Villarreal have a great chance of getting through.
Valencia, you mean?
Oh, sorry, Valencia. Valencia.
Valencia have been the perennial team that just know how to draw games, and if they're going to get a draw away and they go back to the Mestalla, it'll make things very interesting.
Mestalla is one of the most intimidating venues in all of football, and I think, you know, maybe a little bit of ignorance from the rest of Europe, from England in particular, as to their qualities. I mean, they've got Gonzalo Guedes. They've got, you know, quite a few gifted footballers in that side that are a little bit unheralded in the wider circle. Soler, Parejo. I think they could beat Arsenal. I really do. That's one caveat I would have. I don't think Eintracht Frankfurt is going to have enough to beat Chelsea.
I had to eat a big humble pie about Napoli, who are very disappointing against Arsenal, but I just think Arsenal and Chelsea. I think Chelsea will beat Eintracht Frankfurt. I just have a feeling that Chelsea are going to win the Europa League and have a very unconvincing league season. It seems like that's their thing. Like when they finished seventh and won the Champions League, it almost is becoming a bit of a bit of a constant in a way. Just, I'm going to touch on this very, very briefly before we go. I don't know if you've seen the race for fourth in Serie A. About five teams gunning for it at the moment. And there's almost everyone's tripping over each other at the moment. No one's getting wins. You've got Milan, Atalanta, Roma, Lazio, Torino. It is all a logjam. Who's going? Like, in my opinion, I want to say Milan, but I can't even be convinced in saying it. It's going to be Milan or Atalanta for me. Who's going through to fourth?
I think it's Atalanta. I'm sorry.
You don't have to apologise. I'm just as frustrated about this.
I think Gattuso is probably out the door.
Yeah, he is.
I think he's done. Didn't think he was a good appointment in the first place. But Atalanta, they're an exciting team to watch. If you haven't seen Atalanta play this season, you should have a look because they're dynamic. Duvan Zapata, you know, Gomez, Pasalic.
Ilicic.
They've got such an attacking team. I think they will get the goals in the last few rounds to be able to qualify for that last Champions League spot. And I think the Champions League will be all the richer for their presence.
It'll be fantastic to see Atalanta in it. Not at the expense of my boys. I think it'd be even richer if AC Milan got in there because obviously you had the legacy.
They're
think
a
about
boring
the legacy.
Team.
You got to think about the legacy. But interesting point, though, about Milan before we go. Maurizio Pochettino apparently has been courted by AC Milan along with Maurizio Sarri to potentially take over next season. Probably Gattuso's already been told that he's done. And he's just got to see the season out, get him to fourth. And he's actually said, this is interesting, he's willing to move aside because his passion for Milan doing well over is more than him actually coaching him. So if he can't do it, then he's prepared to step aside.
You're just blinded by emotion in these things.
I'm upset because we were playing so well and then there's just been this weird run where they just have fallen way off. Oh, it's
well, we could talk about Milan all night. I'm sure Nick will continue to do so off air.
Well, thank you. I'm talking about booing.
To all who have tuned in, make sure you stick around for Evenings on FNR. And if you're still watching Hamilton at Zuri supporters, Jim Sneesby will be on Evenings on FNR at 5:45 Australian Eastern Standard Time. The big discussion on all things NCIP and the controversy in Northern New South Wales. Stick around for that. But this has been the lightning round. Until next week, it's bye for now.
It's time for the lightning round on FNR, Football Nation Radio.